And we'll get into that story in just a second. But let me just start by asking, the question I want to talk to you about this morning is, why should you take Jesus seriously? That's a simple question. Why should you take Jesus seriously? But by that, I don't just mean why should you notice him or pay him a bit of respect. What I mean is, why does Jesus deserve to get a lot from you? Why does he deserve to get treated not just as an interesting guy from the past, somebody important, somebody you vaguely want your kids to know about, say, but as someone who gets to be at the centre of your life? Why should you let Jesus into your life, into your home? Let him start to rearrange things. Why should you listen when he calls you to change things? Why should he get to require you and maybe require your family to use up a big chunk of your weekend and your week, perhaps, doing weird things with weird people? Sorry, no offence, don't know you very well, but that's true of my church. And to start to spend your money in different ways, your time. Why should you open your heart up to him and show him all the most precious, intimate truths about you? Why should you give him a say about what you love and how you love it, what you're afraid of, what you're after in life? Why should you take Jesus that seriously? Because that's a big ask, isn't it? You'd need a pretty good reason to do that. You'd need to be sure that this was the right call. If you were going to take someone that seriously, you'd need to know that they deserved it, wouldn't you? That they were worth it. Well, it turns out, though, that Jesus has an answer that is more than big enough. More than big enough. And we will find our way to the answer if we think a little about the story that was read just now from Mark's Gospel, chapter 9, although not all of the answer is in that story. So would you look at it with me? It'd be great to have it, the printed one open before you. I'll refer to the verse numbers, the sentence numbers as we go through. It will take us a little while for the important things to emerge, but stay with it. I think it'll be worth your while. Okay, well, the story begins with Jesus taking these three disciples, Peter, James and John, up a mountain. So who were these guys? The short answer is that they were pretty normal people. All three of them were fishermen who had lived all their lives on and around Lake Galilee. Lake Galilee is a large lake. It's about 25 times the size of Lake Burley Griffin in the north of Israel, out of which the Jordan River flows down to the Dead Sea. As far as we can tell, these three men lived day to day mostly in a world of getting by. They helped run family fishing businesses. They used skills they'd learnt over many years. They tried to catch enough for the day and for the week. They were preoccupied with the details of the work. They had to mend nets, find the fish, gut them, all that stuff. They got up very early and went home very tired at the end of the day. They probably loved their wives and children. They went to church, or rather to synagogue, on the weekend. But then this man had come along. Jesus. And he had started unsettling all of this. He had called them to follow him, and something about who he was and what he was doing had made them do it. And they went with him. They started spending time with him, going with him. At first it was just in their hometown, Capernaum, up there in Galilee. But then astonishing things had happened that meant they had to stay on with him. People had been healed, even Peter's own mother-in-law, perhaps to his frustration, who knows. Impossible problems had been straightened out, things you never thought would have been possible. And this man had begun to teach about life and about God with an authority that put him in a different league to anyone they'd ever met. Jesus had started to challenge people, especially the religious leaders. And they had started to react, but he'd kept on, kept going, kept moving, as if something incredibly important was happening. He talked about it as the kingdom of God, and he was deadly serious. He gave them positions in this kingdom, made them his kind of right-hand men. Yet it had also become really clear that there was going to be conflict with this. The disciples, like these guys, had started to steel themselves to get ready. They could handle it. They were serious fellows. They wouldn't shrink from a fight if it came to it. But Jesus didn't seem to want to fight. He'd started to say things they didn't expect about suffering and the need to lose their lives, and it had rattled them. Well, in a nutshell, this is what happens in Mark's gospel up to the point in our story, the first eight chapters. If you haven't read it before or not for a long time, can I just suggest you should do it? It's better than you probably remember or have expected. Now, the Gospels are ancient biographies of Jesus. They're different to modern biographies in many ways, but they still have the same aim, to show you who is this person and why do they matter. And just by the way, let me also say, please don't dismiss the Gospels as historically unreliable or think they're kind of made up myths and legends. They're nothing of the sort, and most historians don't treat them that way. They're serious pieces of history built on the testimony of eyewitnesses. We find that difficult, right? Because they're full of strange things, like the ones in our story today, and we're not used to strange things. But if you think about it, that's not actually a good enough reason to write them off. It might just as much be a reason to think you need to question your view of the world a little bit. Now, that's all a conversation for another time. Please follow it up if you want to. But let me say just one more thing, because it relates to our passage. One of the reasons historians take the Gospels seriously is because of what is called the evidence of embarrassment. That is, there are things in the Gospels that would have been quite embarrassing to the early church. And so it's hard to imagine them being made up and put in there. They don't make sense as a kind of invention of this church. And there's a good example in our passage, in the way Peter, who became the most important leader in the early church, here he looks like a bit of a dill. Have a look with me as we follow along. So Jesus takes these three disciples, Peter, James and John, up a mountain. And then we're told, verse 2, I think, yep, the end of it, there he was transfigured before them. That is, his appearance changed somehow. His clothes became dazzling white, it says in verse 3, whiter than any nappy sand could make them. And finally, there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Now, what is that about? What's going on here? Well, one level, I think this is just a very strange and overwhelming experience. Jesus changed. He shone. He was glorious. It's troubling and mysterious. Elijah and Moses, though, we can say something about them. They're two of the greatest characters of the Old Testament. They are the greatest prophets, which means the special people through whom God spoke to Israel and who brought the truth about God to the people. Them appearing with Jesus is a big deal because it says Jesus is like these guys. He's with these guys, and these guys are important. To risk a kind of trivial analogy, right? Imagine you're a cricket player and you go into the dressing room one morning and there is your team captain sitting talking to Don Bradman and Dennis Lilly. You know, you'd see him in a new light, right? Well, the disciples are being shown here that Jesus is like Elijah and Moses, someone through whom God's truth is being brought to the world. And then Peter speaks up. He's not a kind of staying silent type, Peter. He speaks up. Verse 5. Peter said to Jesus, Rabbi, which means my teacher, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Why does he say this? It's well meant. It's definitely well meant. He's probably thinking of Jewish festivals that involve shelters. I think he's trying to be respectful and useful. I think he was a pretty hands-on guy. But it's also kind of off the mark. It comes across as a comment that is awkward and out of place. He did not know what to say, Mark tells us in verse 6. They were so frightened. I think he and the others were just way out of their depth. They had suddenly got in on something that was well beyond them. They didn't belong there. When he says, it's good for us to be here, I think you get the feeling that he's trying to find some way to avoid the obvious truth that there was really no way they should be there at all. They had been let in on something here that was way above their pay grade. But this is not a time for Peter and the others to help. Not a time for them to do anything, to make a contribution. Their only job is to take it in. That's made totally clear by the final thing that happens here in verse 7. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud. This is my son whom I love. Listen to him. In the Bible, there's only one who speaks from a cloud like that. In the Old Testament, it's a standard way for God to appear, because God is invisible. Even when he appears, you don't actually see him. But his voice is heard. And here it is heard telling the disciples to pay attention, because this one, this shining one, Jesus, is his son whom he loves. And then it's all over, suddenly. Verse 8, when they looked around, suddenly they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. They're left there on the mountain in the dark with their friend, who they now see, to put it mildly, in a new light. What the disciples experience here is a kind of unveiling, a kind of tearing back of the curtain on the reality of who Jesus is, who this man they've been with, this man they've been so mesmerized by, this person they've become friends with. Now suddenly the lid is lifted, the curtain is torn back, and they get shown who this really is. If ever there was one, right, this is a reason to take Jesus seriously. That's the message for these disciples. Do you get who this is, guys? Do you get who you're with? Do you see it? Do you hear it? This is the beloved Son of God, the one on whom God's attention and love and care has been fixed from all eternity. Will you pay attention to him now? Will you listen to him? Take him more seriously than you've ever taken anything else? There's a curious thing, though, which is this. Here's the puzzle. Although that's the reason the disciples are given to take Jesus seriously, it's not a reason that is given to anyone else. Did you notice that? Because straight away, Jesus tells them they have to keep this a secret. Let me show you what I mean. It says that, verse 9, as they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. He gave them orders. He was really serious about this. He didn't want people to know this. Why not? If this was true, if this was something that had happened, why wouldn't he want people to know? Right? Because Jesus did want people to take him seriously. He clearly thought, as I mentioned before, he had important things to say and to do. He was on a mission. He was talking about the kingdom of God, and he wanted people to listen. He had said that many times, made it clear. You never ever get the sense when you read the Gospels that Jesus was just having a laugh. He was in earnest. So why the secrecy? Why not get this out there? That this is the Son of God, that he deserves your attention. Don't write him off. Now, perhaps it was partly that he didn't think people would believe the disciples if they did tell people they'd had this amazing experience. You know, I'm sure that's right. I don't think people would have believed them. But I don't think that solves the puzzle. Because, of course, if this really was true about Jesus, if this really was who he was, the Son of God, then surely he could have made that known in a clear and compelling way. He could at least have brought more than just these three friends up the mountain, right? He could have let this happen in broad daylight, in public, or done some other public demonstration. In fact, it makes you start to suspect that this couldn't really have happened. He couldn't really be the Son of God. This couldn't really be the truth about Jesus because, you know, if he was the Son of God who could shine with the glory of his Father, if that was true, why wouldn't he make that plain? If you're the Son of God, Jesus, why not show us? Why not make it clear? How convenient that at this moment, when it all became clear, it was only you and your closest friends. Do you know, people did ask Jesus exactly this. In John's Gospel, we hear people say to him, if you were the Messiah, tell us plainly. And at his trial, just before his death, those who examine him ask the same. They say, if you are the Messiah, tell us plainly. Why keep us in suspense? If he was the Son of God, why didn't he just come out and make that clear, like he did with these disciples? It would have made our job a whole lot easier, wouldn't it? Would it? Would it? Let me ask you to think about something honestly. What difference do you think it would have made if Jesus had done that? If he had told everyone plainly or shown himself in glory like he did with his disciples, how much would it have changed the way people responded to him? We like to think that if we were in that position, we would respond reasonably. We like to think that we're honest enough that if we saw something like Peter and John and James saw, and if we heard a voice like that, well, that would be enough for us, right? Then we would take Jesus as seriously as he deserved to be taken. How could we not, right? If we had an experience like this that left us in no doubt about where the truth lay, no doubt anymore about what God himself cared for, what mattered in the universe, surely that would make us resolve to stand with this man forever, to listen to him, serve him, no more indecision. Surely. But would we, I wonder? Actually, I wonder if we would be more resistant to that kind of clarity than we think we would be. If something like this happened, I think it's just as likely that some of us at least would find a way to be looking the other way at the crucial moment. Find a way to avoid having to change too much. We'd find a reason to think it wasn't quite so simple as that, a reason to doubt that it was all quite that clear. Because part of us doesn't actually want to know something like this. It's frightening. It's unsettling. We don't really want to be challenged like this. We're fairly happy with how things are, and we don't really want our lives turned upside down. It's too difficult. Okay, but even if that's not true, even if that didn't happen, and if we saw and heard something that was undeniable, if God made things totally clear so that we were persuaded and we resolved to serve Jesus, here's the question then. Would we be able to follow through with it? Would we be able to do justice to a revelation like that? Would it really change us? Here's where things get really confronting. Because remember that that is what happened to Peter. In this moment, he was shown beyond doubt that Jesus was the truth. He was the one to follow. If he had any doubts before, they were gone now. God himself spoke out of the cloud and told him that he was his son and to pay attention. And so Peter resolved to follow Jesus whatever the cost. He stayed with him. He trusted him. He threw himself in with Jesus. I will never leave you, he said to Jesus a little later on in Mark. Lord, he said, I am ready to go with you to prison and to death. Just imagine yourself getting to a point like that of being, imagine yourself being willing to make that kind of commitment. But then when it came to it, Peter couldn't do it. You may know the story. It's recorded in Mark chapter 14. It's another good example, actually, of the evidence of embarrassment. Just a short while after he made these declarations of loyalty, Peter ends up denying that he knows Jesus at all. Three times he denies Jesus in the strongest terms he can. He calls down curses upon himself to kind of back up his lie. When it comes to the crunch, he saves his own skin. He cannot follow through on his commitment. And here's where it matters that we realize that Peter is much like us. Do you know, friends, this is a point. This is the point where Christianity is different from almost every other faith and worldview. Because according to the Christian faith, what we all need most is not just enlightenment, but redemption. Let me explain that. What I mean is that according to Christianity, according to the Bible, what we need is not just for things to become clear for us. That's what we think. It's what many religions teach, that what we need is enlightenment. We need to come to see the truth. Some say this will come through religious teaching. Some say it will come through some kind of spiritual experience. Some say it will come through scientific inquiry and rational knowledge. When people say that the solution to humanity's problems is more education, they're saying much the same thing, that what we need most is to come to know something. We need to come to see the truth. We need enlightenment. Christianity, though, it says we need more than that. Not less. It's not that we don't need to know the truth. We do. But Christianity teaches that just knowing the truth will not be enough for us. Because our problem is not just ignorance. It's our hearts. The problem is not just that we don't know what is true. It's that often we don't want to know. And we can't follow through on it, even when we do. Do you know, I reckon we know this about ourselves in one way or another. I reckon we know that we are not really very honest and rational all the time. But more often than not, we're caught up in our passionate impulses. We're kind of addicted to ourselves and our own way of seeing things and our own enjoyment. Christianity teaches that Peter shows us the truth about us all, which is that just knowing the truth is not enough for us to do what is right, because we don't stay with it. We lose our grip on it. We protect ourselves. We don't do justice to the truth, even when we find it. Our problem is not just our ignorance, it's our hearts. And Jesus knew this. Jesus knew this, and it was the reason he ordered the disciples to keep quiet about what they'd seen. It was the reason he didn't just show himself plainly, like people wanted him to. Because he knew that that wouldn't be enough. And so he chose a different path, a much harder path for himself. To show himself plainly, right, that would probably have led to great power and influence, perhaps even over the whole world. But it wouldn't have changed our hearts. And so he trod a different path. He says in Mark's Gospel, just after our passage, he says this, "The Son of Man," by which he meant himself, "the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus didn't come to make himself known so that he'd be honored. He came to do something for us, to serve us, to give his life as a ransom for many. He came not just to reveal something, but to act, to do something that only he, as the Son of God, could do, to lay down his life as a sacrifice to set us free. This, according to Christianity, is what we really need. Not just new teaching, new knowledge, enlightenment, but a rescue, an act of redemption. We need Jesus, the one who shone with the glory of God the Father, on whom the pleasure and love of God had been fixed from all eternity. We need him to stand and to die in our place to save us. Friends, I began by asking, why should you take Jesus seriously? Let me end by saying that this is the reason to take Jesus seriously. Because he took you seriously first. He took you seriously enough to do what you needed, not just what you wanted. He took you seriously enough not just to show you something, the truth, and hope you could do justice to it, but to give up his life so that you could be forgiven and have it. So what about you? What do you think you need? What do you think you need? Is it just clarity, certainty, enlightenment? Would that be enough for you? Would you be able to do justice to the truth if you found it? Would you want it? Do you really want it? And would you be able to follow through on it? Or are you willing to think that you need something more than that? That you need not just enlightenment, but redemption? If you can see that, and you can see that this is what Jesus, the much-loved Son of God, came to offer you, and if you want to respond to that and want to begin to really take Jesus seriously, then can I invite you to say a prayer with me right now in response?